Watch Podcast. I'm Aaron Berger, a Nebraska Extension educator. For today's Beef Watch Podcast, we're going to turn to our monthly cattle health topic and discuss bovine anaplasmosis. To have a conversation about this, we're joined by Dr. Matt Hilly, who's an assistant professor and diagnostic pathologist at the University of Nebraska Veterinary Diagnostic Center. Thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Aaron.
Dr. Hilly, help us better understand this disease, anaplasmosis, in beef cattle. It's also can impact dairy cattle as well, but it's a significant economic impact. It's estimated that this disease worldwide has an estimated loss of over $1 billion to the cattle industry. So obviously it's very significant in terms of its impact. Help us better understand this disease.
Sure. Yeah. So it is certainly a significant disease in terms of economic impact, particularly in the southern parts of the U.S. It's a unique disease in several aspects. And I think that's why I believe a lot of people are confused oftentimes about anaplasmosis. So it is a bacteria. It is a gram-negative intracellular bacteria, but it behaves as a parasite then because it needs the host cells. It's an obligate intracellular bacteria. So oftentimes people will refer to it as a rickettsial parasite, and I think that can bring about some confusion. So the easiest way to think about it is a bloodborne disease within the erythrocytes or the red blood cells of cattle. So a lot of the reason for the geographic spread is due to the biological vector that's needed. So certain ticks can be biological vectors, meaning they can actually replicate the bacteria in their own gut, and then when they feed on a blood meal, spread the disease. So that's why a lot of times we see it in the southeast part of the U.S.
So historically, we've seen the use of antibiotics fed through mineral or other aspects to try to help combat this disease. Help us understand a little bit in terms of how the disease works. You mentioned the vector of a tick, but how does this impact cattle, thinking here of young cattle, older cattle? Is there differences there?
Yeah, there is. So when it affects these red blood cells, it leads to more of a chronic disease that can lead to an anemia, meaning a decreased in these red blood cells. So these red blood cells in our bodies, as well as cattle, are responsible for carrying oxygen. So what we see when that's decreased is low oxygen levels in all these tissues. So it's a multi-systemic or multi-organ disease that it can affect. So it's within these red blood cells, and we don't see clinical disease near as often in young calves. And the assumption there is because these calves, even though they are positive or have the bacteria within some of their red blood cells, they're better at regenerating these erythrocytes, which wanes as they get older. And that's why we tend to see clinical effects in these cows, middle to older age cows. And like I said, it's a multi-systemic disease overall. So a lot of times there's not one specific organ that we can point to, you know, that failed. But what we tend to see either antemortem before they die or on necropsy is severe icterus. And that's due to that anemia. So if they're alive and we're doing a physical exam, the whites of their eyes might be very yellow. And then on a necropsy, when we open these up, the subcutaneous fat throughout the body, and particularly in the abdomen, is a very bright yellow. So that really would tip a person off to a potential anaplasmosis.
As far as trying to prevent and treat this in cattle, what are our options there?
It kind of depends a lot on where a person is at. So I mentioned the geographic predilection for the southeast. So frankly, those folks down there just pretty much have to try and manage it and deal with it. And so they can do that with things like antibiotics in the feed, like you mentioned, or free choice mineral. CTC is labeled for management of anaplasmosis. And then we can use injectables to treat clinical cases. But in reality, we're not going to get rid of that in vast majority of these cases. They'll become chronic carriers and they can spread it to other animals. So down in the southeast part of the U.S., they just, like I said, kind of have to try and manage it, but deal with it. And we're kind of at this interface here in Nebraska where we do have anaplasmosis, but it's not endemic here like it is in those other parts of the country. So in Nebraska, for example, we can go more of a more aggressive management where we can actually test and cull. And that's, in my opinion, probably the best approach for a herd in Nebraska that thinks they may be dealing with it, is to completely to test those cows and then cull any of the positives, knowing that they're highly likely to be chronic carriers in their own herd. So that's how the management can kind of change on in the approach, you know, that's guided on how big of an issue it is in your area.
One of the other things you mentioned that comes to mind for me, this being a bloodborne disease, I guess any management practices around vaccinations or things like that that we need to be aware of if we suspect that anaplasmosis could be an issue?
So there is at least one vaccine available, to my knowledge. Quite frankly, I don't think there's much data to support its use. It's fairly expensive. And so I think it's very safe to say that if it does work at all, it's very poor. And that's a lot because this is a difficult disease to make a vaccine to, because, like I said, it's a unique bacteria and they're within these red blood cells. So oftentimes they can, for lack of a better term, kind of hide out and evade the immune system. So it's very difficult to make a vaccine for it. I would say there's probably not one available now that's efficacious, but there is a lot of groups working on these, and there's in the past couple of years been some progress there that I think is cause for optimism regarding potential vaccine in the future.
If you do have calves that get exposed to this as calves, do they develop any immunity themselves, or is it just that they have it present and then don't exhibit it till later in life?
No, they can. And in fact, I believe I've never practiced in the Southeast, but I think that's a common practice down there for calves that people are planning to retain ownership of, is to purposefully inoculate them, using needles that you used from your cows for vaccinating those calves, things like that. I think there's certain evidence that that can help decrease the severity of the disease later in life, but it's not going to prevent that carrier status or the potential for a carrier status in an individual animal.
So you just mentioned the possibility of spreading the disease with needles. I guess as we think about Nebraska and states on the northern part, does that change how we think about maybe our vaccination program in terms of how often we change needles?
Yeah, I mean, ideally, to completely eliminate that threat of animal to animal, at least as far as we could do with the vaccine, changing needles on every head would be the approach that you'd want to take there. I think not very many people are likely to do that, especially as we get in, like you said, the plains where herds tend to be larger. That's why I think, again, when you're in this area, the best approach is a test and cull. And once you do that once, you put that effort in up front, then all you need to do is routinely test your any new incoming cattle, new bulls that are bought, things like that, before they join the herd. I think that's the best approach in our areas.
What does the testing process look like for this?
So there's two types of tests we can do. We can do a serum test. Both involve just a blood sample. So we can test the serum for antibodies. That's a cheaper test. It's good for screening. So we can look at serum from, say, all your cows, and we can see who has been exposed, meaning who has the antibodies for this test. That indicates previous exposure. Then we can use what's called a PCR test, where we're actually looking for nucleic acid of the bug to determine, yes, she is currently a carrier or is currently infected. So those are the two types. The PCR is a little more expensive. So usually the approach is to screen everybody looking for antibodies. Any cows that show up as being previously exposed or antibody positive, then look for the bug and then eliminate those cows from the herd. So you can effectively, eliminate it from your own place. Obviously, it's not perfect if you have neighbors, things like that, that aren't following the same sort of management practices. But if you wouldn't have to do that very often to kind of, go through and re-clean up later on over the years. That would be the best approach.
So is that just a situation where people pull blood samples and then submit them to a lab to have the analysis done?
Yep. Yeah. And we do that here at the Nebraska Veterinary Diagnostic Center. One thing to keep in mind with doing this is the timing of the blood sample. So it's going to take roughly a month to 6 weeks for these cows to develop the antibodies that we can detect. So ideally, you'd want to take this blood sample 4 to 6 weeks after our first really good hard frost in the year, because then we don't run the risk of showing a negative test when in fact she was just infected, last week, but we just can't find the antibodies. So if you wait till a month or so after that first frost, that can eliminate that potential incorrect result.
Anything else on this topic, this disease we've talked about today that you think would be valuable for producers to understand as they think about management and protection for their own herds?
No, I think we've covered it. If anybody's has thoughts about this, could be a potential in their own herd. You can work with your own local veterinarian on developing the management strategies, that kind of what we've discussed here on what you can do there. But just be aware, I think, that it does exist in Nebraska and can be problematic economically if we aren't aware of it and make appropriate decisions.
Well, Dr. Hilly, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you, Aaron.
For more information on the topic that was discussed in today's Beef Watch podcast, if you have specific questions, you're welcome to contact Dr. Hilly. Again, he's an assistant professor in the Veterinary Diagnostic Center on the campus of the University of Nebraska at Lincoln.